From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
At dusk, the insects came down in a storm. The biting and stinging, the chirping and buzzing and droning, every last one flew into the eyes and mouths and noses of the only three humans they could find.
That's a glimpse of life in the Amazon rainforest, as seen by novelist Ann Patchett. The Amazon is the world's largest remaining expanse of wilderness. It not only has more bugs than you can imagine, it's the Earth's greatest repository of biodiversity. But new roads and pipelines and huge dams are transforming the ecosystem and threatening the indigenous people who live there. Today, we'll take stock of the Amazon, from efforts to protect indigenous cultures to an anthropologist's journey of self-discovery with the help of a powerful hallucinogen.
The result of taking ayahuasca was that it changed my worldview. I suddenly found myself surrounded by these enormous fluorescent serpents that started speaking to me in a kind of telepathic language that went right through my forehead. And the first thing that they said was, "You are just a tiny human being."
But first, the adventure of a lifetime, the story of a journalist's trek deep into the Amazon in search of one of the last uncontacted tribes, the legendary People of the Arrow. On assignment for National Geographic magazine, Scott Wallace joined an expedition led by the Brazilian explorer Sidney Pozuelo, a man who's made it his life's mission to protect the Amazon's indigenous people. Wallace tells the story in his book, The Unconquered.
National Geographic called me and asked me if I were available and willing to take off basically on a moment's notice to go profile Sidney Pozuelo. But to do so, I had to join an expedition that was just about to depart on an open-ended journey into the land of a group known as the People of the Arrow, the Flecheiros, a tribe hiding in the headwaters of an enormous reserve known as the Javari Valley Indigenous Land, an area about half the size of Florida with not a single road, surrounded by a much greater unbroken forest in the western Amazon. It was the kind of assignment you just can't say no to.
What is it about Pozuelo? He really did change everything about not just Brazil's attitude, but the world's attitude toward uncontacted people and undeveloped resources, right?
Yeah. Pozuelo comes out of a tradition in Brazil of wilderness scouts. They're called sertanistas, who would be sent out into the jungle, into the deep bush, to woo so-called wild Indians and to pacify them and make peace with them and move them out of the way, essentially, of the advancing frontier. But midway through his career, Pozuelo saw that inevitably, regardless of the best intentions that he had and his colleagues had, the Indians whom they contacted would inevitably succumb to epidemic diseases because these groups are still defenseless against measles, influenza, the common cold, and the contact would inevitably trigger massive die-offs, in some cases up to 90% mortality of a tribe. And eventually the lands of these tribes in many instances, in most cases, would be overrun by the loggers, the prospectors, the settlers. And so Pozuelo saw this and decided, you know, this is not working out for the Indians. We should change this policy.
So you decided to go with him, but it leads to a sort of basic contradiction, doesn't it? You were going with him to search for a people who, if you found them, you would not contact.
Yeah, it's a pretty paradoxical quest. But the Department of Isolated Indians, curiously named, that Pozuelo was the head of and the founder of, is charged with protecting these last groups of uncontacted tribes. And in order to protect them, they must prove, document their presence on the land in order to then go back to Brasilia and push for legal recognition of those lands.
It's also quite dangerous, though, not just because of the terrain you're going to have to go over, but getting close to the Arrow people, the People of the Arrow, can be pretty dangerous too, right?
Absolutely. Nobody knows what they call themselves because there's never been peaceful contact. You know, they're known regionally by other groups in the forest as the flecheros. They're known to be dangerous, implacable, and people steer very wide of their territory because they're known to use their arrows to defend their territory from any intruders.
So you knew that was what you were going after, but you also knew what you were going to have to go through to get there. What is it like these days to go in under the canopy, as you said, into the Amazon jungle?
It was by far and away the most grueling journey. First of all, we were trekking through a headwaters region, up and down through very steep hollows and ravines and very dense vegetation also. We were going single file with the lead scouts breaking open the way with machetes, and the way was really grueling. I mean, there were days when we'd only advance 2 or 3 kilometers on the map.
Dan, tell me a little bit about this group. It wasn't just you and Pozuelo. In fact, there were representatives of several other tribes with you on this trip.
That's correct. The expedition consisted of 34 men, including 20 Indians from 3 different tribes who were fantastic backwoodsmen. They were our hunters, our fishers, our porters, trackers.
Of course, you had to keep your goal in mind through all of this, but it must have been hard because the stories you tell are pretty daunting. The story you tell of termites discovering them all over your shirt would make anybody want to go home.
Yeah, there were quite a few discomforts, that's for sure. Sweat, filth, bugs, snakes.
You were unable to keep your glasses on at one point because they'd fog up before you could step.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they'd fog up almost at every step. You know, there was a point where my feet went out from under me in slick mud, and I came down on a sapling that one of the scouts had whacked off to a very sharpened point with his machete. And I came down on that point, and within a fraction of an inch, really, of just being impaled.
There were some other advantages, I gather, to having the Indian representatives with you. There was something with the Matis elders.
Mm-hmm.
They put drops in your eyes that helped you see better.
So one day we're in the midst of the trek. We had taken a break around the middle of the day, and Pozuelo said, take a look at what the Matis are doing over here. It's really worth checking out. And they were in the midst of grinding up some kind of bark shavings and mixing it with water and folding it into like a banana leaf to create an eyedropper. And then each of the expeditionaries would prostrate themselves on their knees in front of one of the Tepi, one of the Matisse Indians with us, and receive these drops from this concoction in their eyes. And you could tell that it really burned from their reaction, their grimacing. And they were chanting too. And then they wanted me to receive these drops. And first I thought, you know, this is not something for me, but, you know, peer pressure. And I thought, hey, you only live, you know, through this once. So I too got on my knees and let him drop this concoction in my eyes. It felt like sulfuric acid had been dropped in there. It was this burning sensation. It was almost indescribably painful. And it took a few minutes before I could even open or begin to blink. But once I did, the forest stood out in really sharp relief. It was almost like a hyper realism to the forest. You could distinguish depth. The forest is mostly like a two-dimensional monochromatic green and brown, but after taking these drops, you could distinguish with much more clarity the dimensions of the forest, and it also took away fatigue. Turns out the Matisse use this concoction on a regular basis when they go hunting because it heightens their sense of sight, their hearing, and their ability to move through the forest.
So what happened when you finally did realize that you were getting close to the arrow people, the flecheros? You knew how dangerous they were, and I suppose you both wanted to find them and didn't.
Yeah, that's right. As we went through the forest, our scouts, both Pozuelo and the Indians, they were so good at being able to judge how long ago what they called vestigios, the vestiges that people leave behind when they walk through the jungle, even things as simple as snapping off twigs. We would see these signs, but they would always be a year, a couple of months, or a few weeks ago that the people had been through there enough time to presuppose a certain margin of safety in terms of distance until one day when we came upon fresh footprints pressed into the mud, and one of our trackers said, these are from right now. These footprints are from right now. And it was like, you know, adrenaline rush, you know, hearts pounding, and we could hear voices in the jungle in front of us. And then all of a sudden, even though our mission was to avoid contact, the group discipline broke down at that moment, and everyone rushed forward to try to get a glimpse of these people. So suddenly our ranks broke, and we're all like running through the forest. And a couple of our lead scouts caught a glimpse of two of these Indians as they dashed across a makeshift bridge. It was actually two trees that had fallen into the water from opposite banks of this river, and they dashed across this log bridge and disappeared into the jungle on the far side of the river.
And you had sense enough not to dash across that bridge to follow them.
Well, yeah. I mean, our mission was not hot pursuit. But what happened right there was that was the moment that the Arrow people discovered that we were in their land. And what Pozuelo did at that point was order all of us down to the river. There was a sandy beach there, and ordered everyone to string themselves out along the beach with their rifles. Of course, I didn't have a rifle, but everyone else did. And he said, you know, let them see, because we knew they were watching us, even though we couldn't see them. He said, let them see how many we are, and let them see how well-armed we are. He wanted to preempt any thoughts that they might have of attacking us. And that was part of Pozuelo's calculus, to go into their territory with a contingent that was large enough and well-armed enough to dissuade them from attacking us.
Of course, now you knew and you could go back, but you had to go back through the same territory again. So the same adventures, only in reverse.
Actually not. Once we had traversed their land, we were not going to go back the same way we came out. In the middle of the wilderness on this adjacent river, we stopped, and in the course of 2 weeks, our men, with axes and machetes only, no power tools, built two enormous dugout canoes in the middle of the wilderness, opened them with fire. I'd never seen this process before. It was an ancient art. And then even carved the paddles for the canoes and launched these canoes on the river. And that's how we got back to civilization, was by paddling for 2 weeks, 12 hours a day downriver to a point that was deep enough in the river for a boat to come and get us.
Wow. So was it successful? Did Pozuelo achieve what he wanted?
I think he did. It's hard to measure success sometimes with things of this sort, but the Arrow people remain well protected by all accounts and recent aerial surveillance. It seems their communities are actually thriving. And so we found out a lot about the Arrow people from this expedition. And also what we gleaned from the expedition was leveraged politically into bolstering support for the reserve where they are.
Journalist Scott Wallace. His book is called The Unconquered, In Search of the Amazon's Last Uncontacted Tribes. Coming up, a story of anthropology, shamanism, and ayahuasca. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
20-some years ago, a young Marxist anthropologist named Jeremy Narby went down to the Peruvian Amazon to investigate the plight of indigenous people. His agenda was political. He wanted to help the Ashaninka Indians secure legal rights to the land they lived on, as timber companies and other developers moved in. What Narby didn't know was that his experience with the Ashaninka would transform his own life, especially once he tried their powerful hallucinogen, ayahuasca. As he tells Steve Paulson, the Ashaninka had an entirely different way of seeing the world.
Well, they essentially viewed plants and animals as people or as intentional beings with whom you could communicate in modified states of consciousness. So this was off the radar of what was considered knowledge in universities at that point.
So for you, an anthropologist with a PhD from Stanford, someone who came up imbued, I presume, with the values of materialism, rationality, this must have been really strange.
Correct. But yeah, I was a Marxist anthropologist. And so, yes, a materialist, a humanist, a rationalist. And I thought I knew what reality was in terms of atoms and molecules and so on. And yeah, it flew in the face of my understanding of reality. But in fact, as an anthropologist, when Indians start saying strange things, you think, oh, well, I'm in business. This is what anthropologists expect. So the point was, I thought, as an anthropologist, was to try to make sense of it.
And of course, there's also the tradition of the participant observer. And I guess in your case, that meant taking ayahuasca.
Well, that's right. And actually, the Ashaninka people themselves, I kept on beating about the bush. And it was true that they had deep knowledge about plants and plant properties, medicinal plants, all kinds of plants. And this place is the world center of biodiversity. There are more plants and reptiles and amphibians and birds and mammals in this area than in any other area in the world. They had names in their language for almost every species of plant, and they ascribed uses to about half of them. So I eventually started asking the Jesuit question, how do you know what you know? And after a few months, one fellow said, Brother Jeremy, if you want to know the answer to that question, you have to drink ayahuasca. And if you like, I can show you sometime. He said, this is the television of the forest. It allows you to see images and learn things.
So you, there was, what, an evening that was set aside for you to partake in the ayahuasca, this incredibly powerful hallucinogen.
I just was curious, and I thought that I would try it out. I didn't really take it all that seriously. You know, they have dietary prescriptions and said you shouldn't eat this, that, and the other on the day of ingestion. I hadn't actually followed their advice and came to regret it, but...
Because you end up throwing up, then.
And in their language, ayahuasca is called camarampi from the verb camarank, which means to vomit. Hmm. And it also contains the word maranki, which is serpent. So actually, in their language, it is serpent vomit. You know, this is some strong stuff, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, woof. And yeah, well, the result of taking ayahuasca that first time was that it changed my worldview. It actually showed me my worldview and showed me the limits of my worldview. I suddenly found myself surrounded by these enormous fluorescent serpents that started speaking to me in a kind of telepathic language that went right through my forehead. And the first thing that they said was, you are just a tiny human being. And I could see, looking at them, that they were right and that my ordinary worldview, a rationalist, materialist, humanist, had limits, starting with my presupposition that what my eyes were showing me didn't exist. At which point I had to vomit, in fact.
Now, there is another response that I guess what might have been a logical response is, okay, you take this really powerful drug, you see these huge serpents, crazy stuff. And then you regain your normal consciousness and think, okay, yeah, you take ayahuasca and you're going to see all kinds of weird hallucinations. It doesn't have to change your worldview.
Well, what then happened, this is like a 3-hour experience. At one point, what I experienced, at least in my mind's eye, was flying out of my body miles above the planet. And then when the ayahuasquero or shaman modified his melody, I landed, zoomed back down in my body and started seeing hundreds of thousands of images, extremely intricate, beautiful images, such as, for example, the veins of a human hand and the veins of a green leaf flashing back and forth extremely quickly. And it was just obvious that what was being shown to me at that point was the connection between the vegetal and the human. This was something that I'd never thought about. Well, the next day, I went down to the river to kind of freshen up, and I took a leaf of a green bush and held it up to the sun and then compared it to the skin on my hand, and I could see that it was literally true. This was the first time in my life that I felt part of nature. I felt like, oh, okay, I'm like a plant, except I can actually walk around. I'm like a moving plant. And the overall experience was like an antidote to the anthropocentrism of anthropology. And also, these are images that are so powerful, they make ordinary reality look dull. I mean, they're like 10 to 100 times more intense in terms of colors and emotional impact. And once you've seen them, you can't unsee them. That's the thing. I knew from that experience that there was a level of reality that remains invisible to the ordinary gaze, but that is somehow there. It's raging with, well, information and, you know, it's terrifying.
Were you scared at
all?
Yeah,
it's terrifying. Huge fluorescent serpents that tell you're just a tiny little what's-a-name and you know they're right. And minutes before you didn't even think they existed. And it's like hair-raising.
Now, what did the people you were living with, talking with, what did they say about this?
They say this is where they get their knowledge about the plants, animals, forests, the world we're in, about the cosmos. There's no limit to the information that you can get from this source. They say our eyes mislead us. They say plants and animals are humans like us. With our ordinary gaze, we just see their outside envelope. But inside them, when you have taken ayahuasca or tobacco or one of these other plants that teach, then you see the real reality of things, and then you see inside these other species. In their view, you can't really know the world unless you work with these plants and these states of consciousness.
So here you were, this young anthropologist, you know, trying to learn what these people were saying, trying to sort of enter their reality to some degree. Does that mean you had to leave your old reality? I mean, your old preconceptions?
Actually, I did 2 years of field work. I knew that this whole, let's just say, shamanic level of reality was off the radar and kind of off limits for somebody who wanted to get a doctorate from Stanford in the middle of the 1980s. So I turned my back on it and I went back to the university and wrote a dissertation in which ayahuasca and is hardly mentioned. And it took me 8 years to finally go back and roll up my sleeves and start looking at just what these people might be talking about. To me, it finally became a question of, well, almost human rights, really. These people have knowledge about plants that is now widely recognized by science and industry, yet it would seem that the international intellectual community could not even have a conversation with them about the origin of their knowledge. You know, so we can take their plant knowledge, but we can't even sit down at a table with them and have a conversation about where their knowledge comes from in their own terms. These people say that a good part of their knowledge about plants comes from the hallucinations of their shamans.
In other words, it's not just a cultural construct. The idea, I mean, the radical idea here is that the plant itself is telling you something.
Right. And you want to test the idea? Well, then you eat the plant. And that's the thing about ayahuasca, is that you don't have to believe in it. What you do have to do if you want to check it is consume it. What I came to understand was that one way to move forward is to suspend disbelief. We're in an intercultural realm, so we have one way of knowing and we have concepts and then we have things that we consider off limits or that contradict our approach to knowledge. Okay, so we reach the limits of rationalism. On the other side, there's this other system of knowledge. The point is to become agile in both systems. You know, if you're mature enough, you can suspend disbelief and entertain concepts that actually contradict the system of knowledge out of which you come, and you end up being a kind of a translator or a diplomat between systems of knowledge. And I find having several systems of knowledge in my mind at this point is, Well, it's like having an additional camera angle.
Now, the way you're describing this, it's almost as if there are these two planes of reality. Maybe they're parallel in some ways, but they don't intersect at all. And I guess the question is there some way to reconcile?
Well, you see, what I was saying about the reverse camera angle, you're actually looking at the same game. Shamans say there are entities or spirits that are inside us, around us, inside plants, inside animals, that somehow define us and inform us, but that are invisible. Okay. What could be an equivalent concept in Western knowledge? Well, this is the main theme of my book, The Cosmic Serpent. I started playing around with the idea, well, let's just take DNA molecules. Well, actually, they correspond exactly to that. They are inside us. They are inside plants and animals. They are all around us. They inform us, and they somehow determine our reality, and they actually are invisible. Now, this doesn't mean necessarily that the spirit world that the shamans are talking about is exactly the same as the world of DNA molecules that molecular biologists have started talking about. But it could be that there is a correspondence there.
And just to be clear about this, I mean, you are saying that you have come to believe the plant itself can communicate this knowledge.
No, I'm not saying anything about believing. I'm an agnostic. And what I'm really interested in is knowing. Just what is going on when a human being ingests the ayahuasca brew? It's not just one plant, it's two plants. Just what happens in our body minds at that point is a profound mystery. I'm not sure which explanation is the best. Is it just molecules that are locking onto my neurons and then who knows what's happening? Or is it actually, as the shamans would put it, the spirit of the plant that is talking to me? You know, maybe neither the scientists nor the shamans have it right. Maybe in a couple hundred years we'll have a different understanding. I think there's, first of all, a lot of mystery, and even just ordinary consciousness is profoundly mysterious. Just how this non-material film that we see with our eyes springs out of the 3 pounds of jelly inside our skull is not understood. And then what happens when consciousness is modified is even less understood. Where do the images that one sees with ayahuasca come from? Who knows? One thing that's striking about them is that these are images one has never seen before. It is not just jumbled up stuff in the subconscious or what have you. Who knows where it's coming from? Is it coming from inside or outside, or is it coming from outside and perceived as inside? All the big questions involving ayahuasca, involving shamanic states of consciousness, all the big questions have not been answered. What we want to do is stay open, be humble, and say, look, this we don't know. There's so much that we don't know. And that's not defeatism, it's realism.
Anthropologist Jeremy Narby talking with Steve Paulson. Narby's books include The Cosmic Serpent and Intelligence in Nature. You can listen to the show again or comment on any of the interviews you've heard by going to our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, novelist Ann Patchett ventures into the Amazon and discovers that it's more than she can handle. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Suppose for a moment you're a novelist. How would you conjure up the buzzing swirl of life in the Amazon rainforest?
At dusk, the insects came down in a storm, the hard-shelled and soft-sided, the biting and stinging, the chirping and buzzing and droning. Every last one unfolded its paper wings and flew with unimaginable velocity into the eyes and mouths and noses of the only three humans they could find. Marina was less comfortable in the jungle now that she couldn't see it. She felt the plant life pressing against the edges of the water, straining towards them, every root and tendril reaching. This is worse than a hailstorm, Dr. Swenson said, spitting out a small winged beetle onto the deck. We can do without the lights. And then she turned off the lights. In an instant, the veil of insects lifted, and Morena saw nothing as she had never seen nothing before. It was as if God himself had turned out the lights, every last one of them, and left them in the gaping darkness of his abandonment.
That's Ann Patchett reading from her new novel, State of Wonder. It's the story of a young scientist working for a pharmaceutical company who's sent on a mission to Brazil. She's supposed to track down her old mentor, a scientist who may have discovered a miraculous fertility drug. State of Wonder is a fable about medical ethics, but also an exploration of what you find out about yourself when everything goes wrong. Anne Strangechamps wanted to know why Patchett chose this particular setting for her novel.
The Amazon has become a kind of modern icon today. It's got almost a mythic stature in Western culture. Is that part of why you decided to set your novel there?
No, actually. The reason that I set the book there is because I needed a location that had medical magic to it, someplace that was very obscure, someplace with no Verizon or AT&T store, so when my character's phone is lost, she can't go get another one. So I needed isolation. I needed someplace that had malaria. And then I also needed someplace that had possibility, because this is about a development of a drug that is slightly unbelievable, but doesn't seem entirely impossible. And when I sat down with my globe and thought, okay, these are the three things I need, the Amazon was the winner.
How much time did you spend in the Amazon in order to write the book?
I was down there for about 8 or 10 days, which was about 7 or 9 days too long.
You did not fall in love with the place?
You know, it was so great for a few minutes. It was just amazing for a little while and very beautiful and so different, but so claustrophobic. I was actually okay when I was out on the water. Half the time we were on a boat, and that was really quite lovely. When we went into the jungle, I found it very oppressive because you can't do anything by yourself. You can't go take a walk. You can't sit outside. You know, there's always just something that's waiting to eat you. And they control the tourists very closely to keep them safe. Made me a little nuts.
So we should talk about your character, Marina, who Sure. is a pharmaceutical researcher, Western-trained doctor, who heads to the Amazon from pretty much the opposite kind of place. She leaves in the middle of a Minnesota winter and goes down there looking for a deceased lab partner. What's her experience of the Amazon?
She doesn't want to go to the Amazon. She loves Minnesota. She's a real homebody. The difference between Minnesota and the Amazon, when I thought about where I wanted her to start out, not only did I want her to start someplace cold, but someplace with a wide open field of vision. It is flat and open, and everything is visible. Everything is as it seems. And again, once you're in the Amazon, unless you are on a boat in the middle of the river, you can't see more than 5 feet in any direction, which for some people, me, Morena, is a little unnerving. So I wanted to take her geographically, physically, as far as I could from one extreme to the other. And it's very shocking to her, but it also gives her an opportunity to really find out what she's capable of. Marina keeps losing things. This is really a journey of loss, from her luggage to her notion about what she knows about medicine, about human nature, about how the world operates. She keeps getting stripped down of all of her ideas and thrown into this world that she can't possibly succeed in. And yet she does, because it forces her to find her own inner resources.
It's kind of like one of those classic quest stories in which you're required to surrender everything, including your sense of self, before
Absolutely.
You can find the prize.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's the Buddha's journey in a way. Mm-hmm.
And like a lot of the quest stories also, there's a moment at the beginning, a kind of entrance, which really is a kind of symbolic death. Marina gets sick, really sick. I mean, maybe with the same fever that killed her lab partner. And she doesn't just go get some antibiotics. She winds up drinking some sort of noxious brew from the local shaman.
Right. Well, and again, that's about giving up because, of course, she's a doctor. And this is way outside of her comfort zone. But she's too sick to leave the room. And I think anybody who has traveled a lot has had that experience. And maybe you've had it in Indianapolis and maybe you've had it in Manaus, but that feeling of being so sick and alone in a hotel that you couldn't possibly lift a finger to help yourself. You just kind of submit to the tile bathroom floor and you think either I'm going to die here or I'm not. And you don't really care at that moment. And at that point, one of the only people that she knows in Manaus brings her not something from the drugstore, but something from the shaman stand in the open market. And because she really has no choice, you know, this is the only thing she has to try. And her friend really bullies her into it. She does, in fact, drink the sludge.
But that's such an interesting moment, or at least I found the sludge really interesting because, as you said, she's a pharmaceutical researcher. I mean, she studies clean Western drugs which have been abstracted from their natural origins. And here she's drinking this stuff, who knows what's in it, and it cures her.
It is the natural origin. It is the origin itself. It does cure her, and it cures her by almost killing her, by taking her much, much farther down the pike. You know, she thinks that she is at her absolute end when she drinks the sludge, but the sludge, in fact, takes her someplace much, much deeper. It's a real Dante-esque sort of moment. She's going to go all the way down to the bottom of hell before she can turn around and come back up again.
Well, this is the first non-Western drug she experiences, and of course, she's down there looking for a kind of renegade drug researcher, a doctor who works for her and is funded by her pharmaceutical company who has sort of been out of contact with them for years. What's going on?
Dr. Swenson, who used to be her teacher in medical school, who she both worshipped and was terrified of, has found a tribe of women in the Amazon who can maintain fertility for the rest of their lives. They chew on the bark of a tree and they have children until they die. Dr. Swenson has been funded by this pharmaceutical company to go down there and synthesize the drug and bring back a compound that can be sold to Western women so that we too can put off all of our choices until we're 80 and we can have a baby anytime we want.
Speaking as a woman and someone who has had babies, I'm not really sure that's anything to be desired.
No. In fact, often when I say that, the audience of a certain age really does gasp and recoil, like I've shown them a very old dead squirrel or something. And I always say, oh, it's a horror novel. But it's a cautionary tale. I mean, really, we keep pushing the envelope as to how far off we can put our decisions as women about our reproductive choices. I'm 47. I don't have children. And yet, every now and then, someone still resurfaces to say, well, maybe you're still thinking about it.
The scary thing, I think, about that moment in the book is you can so see that happening. I mean, if a drug like that were discovered in the Amazon, of course some pharmaceutical company would want to market it. It would become the new, you know, holy grail of fertility drugs.
And we are kind of inching towards it. I mean, it's not the craziest drug I could have invented. And when I did invent it, I was just making a list in my own mind about, okay, what would a really profitable drug be? What would a drug be that would be so profitable that a pharmaceutical company would really allow a researcher to have a blank check? And I thought effortless weight loss, everlasting youth, fantastic thick hair, which frankly, That's the one. That's the one I would really go all the way to the wall for. Or eternal fertility. I wasn't sitting down thinking, oh, okay, politically, what would be interesting? Or this is really a book about women's choices. I wasn't thinking about that at all. I was just thinking money. What would be the biggest cash in a bottle that a pharmaceutical company could put together?
Novelist Ann Patchett, talking with Anne Strangechamps. Patchett's novel is called State of Wonder. Now, the story of a real-life Amazon explorer, the great 19th-century British naturalist Alfred Russel Wallace, the co-discoverer with Charles Darwin of the theory of natural selection. Unlike the aristocratic Darwin, Wallace always had to make a living. And he did so by collecting animal specimens in far-flung places, like the Amazon River Basin, and then selling them to museums and wealthy collectors. His fieldwork, first in the Amazon and later in the Malay Archipelago, gave him the raw data to formulate his theory of evolution. But his work often came at a cost. One night, in 1852, while working in the Amazon, he overheard his porters plotting to kill him and steal his possessions. Wallace managed to escape, but later nearly died when his ship back to England caught fire and sank. Today, Alfred Russel Wallace remains a mysterious figure, unlike the more famous Darwin. Historian James Moore has long been fascinated by Wallace. He stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
Now, we should elaborate on the different backgrounds of Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace, the two co-discoverers of the theory of evolution. Darwin grew up a gentleman, grew up with a certain aristocratic background, with privilege, went to good schools, didn't have to work for a living as he was laboring away on his great theory. Wallace had none of that. In fact, he had to make a living all the way to the very end, even once he was famous.
Darwin was to the manner born, you might say, the scion of rich doctors. Wallace was the son of an impoverished lawyer who made some bad investments and may have gambled. He had to leave school at the age of 13, at 14, and find work. And Wallace became really quite adept at what he did. He helped build boats. He helped build houses. Then he got a break to go abroad and collect for a living.
Collect specimens.
Yes, insects, for example, for rich collectors. And he developed a real taste for natural history and for finding out where rare species live.
And his first great expedition was to go down to South America, to Brazil, to the Amazon, which, of course, as we know, is one of the richest repositories of life on Earth.
Indeed. He was in South America for 4 or 5 years. And unfortunately, there was a fire aboard the ship on which he was returning to England, and all its specimens were destroyed, almost all of them. And
So this is how he was going to make his living. Suddenly it was all gone.
Suddenly it was gone. He had some scraps and he had some papers and he was adrift in a lifeboat and he was finally picked up and delivered back in London. And typical Wallace, he just turned right back around. Within 2 years, he was off again to what is today Indonesia. And he spent 8 years there, traveling about with the ordinary people who live there, making friends with them, picking up the language, picking up the species, and sending them back. And at one stage, he was a supplier to Charles Darwin, who complained about the amount of carriage it was costing for these ducks or whatever to be sent back from Bali and Lombok, where Wallace was exploring. But while he's out there, he also is thinking geographically. That's how he thought. He had a mappy mentality. He was drawing lines saying these things live here, these things live there. This is how they make a living. And he discovered this famous biogeographic boundary called Wallace's line, where you have the placental mammals coming up from the west, stopping, and the marsupials continue on the east. And that is a major phenomenon in the history of life on Earth.
Part of what is so fascinating about the story is that Wallace was 7,000 miles away from England when he came up with this understanding of what came to be known as the theory of evolution, whereas Darwin was doing the same thing across the world, basically coming up with the same idea roughly at the same time.
Remember, Wallace started out his career as a collector, believing in evolution. He started out because he thought it was a good idea, not because he had the evidence for it. What he lacked was a convincing theory. So unlike Darwin, he jumped to conclusions very readily, did Wallace. what he discovered, or rather I should say formulated when he was in the Far East, was what he called a principle. He didn't call it natural selection because he didn't believe that selection really was going on. He believed that adjustments were being made in nature as animals varied slightly from generation to generation, and some were fitter than others to survive. It looked very much like Darwin's theory, and when Darwin first read a statement of it, Darwin said, yeah, it's my theory. But now we realize that Darwin read in haste, and there are significant differences in what Wallace came up with, 7,000 miles and half the Earth away from what Darwin came up with. They were inspired by the same thinker, Thomas Robert Malthus, who talked about how population increases much faster than the food supply can increase. And this was a struggle that Wallace was familiar with in a human context. And when he was in the Far East, he saw how humans struggled amongst themselves and with each other for the limited amount of food. At the same time, he recognized that animals must struggle even more because their populations really do explode. And this led to the principle of survival. So they were close, but it wasn't ultimately the same theory.
Now, there was a momentous coming together of these two men. As you said, Wallace knew Darwin, in fact, supplied Darwin with specimens, then sent Darwin a letter outlining his theory. And Darwin had been working on this theory for 20-some years. Can you describe what we know about Darwin's reaction?
Well, Darwin was flabbergasted. We don't have that original letter today. We don't know exactly what Wallace said to Darwin, but we do have the statement of his theory. Darwin, with help from his friends, was able to claim priority for what he regarded as the same theory, only he'd got there first.
There's always been some question about whether Darwin acted unethically here.
Yes, and there always will be because a lot of the evidence seems to be missing and people say that's part of the conspiracy. I don't think it is, really. But Wallace, after all, was not the professional gentleman whom Darwin and his friends were. Wallace was a kind of person who could be taken advantage of and would be grateful for the opportunity to be associated with people like Darwin. And sure enough, when Wallace heard about the arrangement and that he had been published by the great, and he was great, Charles Darwin at this time, he was full of gratitude and it was fine. He was pleased to defer to Darwin for the rest of his life, even when they disagreed. It was the sort of guy he was. He was really quite a likable fellow. And he was always playing second fiddle in a way to Darwin, and Darwin grew more and more to distrust Wallace's scientific judgment. He says so.
Why was that?
And Wallace got into all kinds of things because he was easily led or easily convinced. He got into evolution. He got into something called mesmerism, which we now call hypnotism. He got into phrenology. That's the science of bumps on the head, telling what kind of person you really are. He got into spiritualism, table turning, all kinds of things that spooky today, but
he went to seances, right?
Yeah, he was. You know, he saw things that he believed were miracles. There was some higher power causing them, he believed, and he believed that people like Darwin should be interested in it. I mean, Darwin went to a seance, and before the fireworks started, he said, "I've got a headache," and he went upstairs. You know, so Darwin really never sat through it, and his wife said, "He really doesn't want to believe it." There's probably some truth in that. I don't think she believed it either. It was a good show. But Wallace took these things seriously. Other people thought it was a parlor game. And that was typical of Wallace. He latched onto things. Later he latches onto socialism and women's liberation, all kinds of things that we don't have such a problem with today. But Darwin thought it was just dotty of the guy and typical of him.
The other thing that Wallace did is he seemed to come to believe, maybe he had always believed this, that human beings were set apart from this story of evolution to some degree, at least the development of the human mind.
From an early age, let's say around 20, that would be the early 1840s, Wallace was convinced that our brains have enormous unknown powers. He saw that first in what you and I understand as hypnotism, which is a bit spooky until you understand how the brain works. But Wallace didn't understand how the brain works, but he assumed that it could do things that we now know can't be done, like moving tables. Only Wallace came to believe that there was a whole world of personal spirits out there working together with us, and it was to those spirits we would go in the afterlife. This was becoming an orthodox fringe belief in America and Britain in the middle of the 19th century. Wallace took it up, but at that time it wasn't clear what was going to become science and what wasn't science. These boundaries were porous and they were ill-defined. So looking at it from the point of view of Wallace in his own time, you can't be sure what the outcome will be. But Darwin and his lot, you know, they weren't sure either, but they knew which side was progress, and progress was on the side of no miracles.
And yet also it would seem that perhaps Wallace was inherently more of an egalitarian than Darwin was.
many of the problems between Darwin and Wallace stem from their social origins. You know, as I like to put it, Wallace had dirt under his fingers. Darwin kept his hands clean. Wallace may have bathed every week or two. Darwin probably bathed every day or two. Darwin had the means to live in the country. He never had to work a day in his life. Wallace had always to work by the sweat of his brow.
Even after he was famous? Even after it became well known that he was the co-discoverer of the theory
of evolution? He lived from pen to mouth. Darwin never had to write a word in his life to live off of his investments from his father. He owned two farms. He was an absentee landlord. Wallace could barely afford to build his own house, and he only had two children, and he had to sell that house in order to find schooling for them, and he moved from place to place. And for fun, he grew up plants, but the rest of the time he spent marking exam papers.
Now, today, we associate Charles Darwin with the discovery of the theory of evolution. I mean, it often goes by the word Darwinism. Wallace certainly isn't forgotten, but he is definitely the lesser figure here. Has he gotten a raw deal in history?
Many people think Wallace has got a raw deal. Many people think that the power of Darwin and his friends in the establishment has marginalized him. Wallace was always marginal.
Because of Wallace's interest in spiritualism?
Because of Wallace's interest in spiritualism and other things that were considered to be disproven or unscientific or anti-scientific. Wallace also believed things passionately that we believe today. He believed that humankind was destroying valuable so-called primitive cultures, that natural habitats were being wasted by rapacious industry, whereas Darwin saw this as an example of progress. The elimination of species, the simplification of habitats, the predominance of the Caucasian race, the loss of anthropomorphous apes, as he called them, this would be a sign that humanity is rising. For Wallace, humanity was falling. Wallace is admirable, although he was obstinate and opinionated. He is admirable because he persisted, undaunted, in the face of formidable opposition, to hold his own views. And of course, he died, remembered very fondly by many people who still regarded themselves as outsiders.
James Moore is a historian of science at the Open University in England and co-author of a major biography of Charles Darwin. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, go to our website at ttbook.org or visit us on our Facebook fan page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show Amazonia. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Sarah Nix, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can listen to the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will find shows and interviews available to stream, download, and share with friends.
PRI, Public Radio International.